This is All In. I'm Matt Pelcher. Lawmakers named mental health services in Indiana schools a top priority after two school shootings occurred in Indiana last year. After tragedies like this occur, lawmakers, education professionals, parents, and students alike start asking what we need to do better. And taking a thoughtful look at mental health services within schools has been at the top of that list. What services should be available to Indiana students? Should mental health care be the responsibility of public schools? And why is this such a problem in our state to begin with? Join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. We especially want to hear from you if you or your children have benefited from mental health services at school. Side Effects Public Media reporter Carter Barrett has been covering this, and she joins us now. Hi, Carter.
Hey, Matt.
Lawmakers named mental health services in schools a top priority after two of the school shootings last year. And when this sort of thing happens, lawmakers, education professionals, students, parents start asking, what do we need to do better? And at the top of that list was taking a thoughtful look at mental health services within schools. And you've been covering this. And when you asked schools what they needed in order to provide these services, their answer was more. More what? What are we talking about?
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends on who you ask, but I think a lot of people would say more money. Other people might say more personnel, which is also money, or better curriculum around social-emotional learning.
When you talk about more money, you're talking about a district with those resources, or perhaps a district maybe that doesn't have those resources. How do we get that money? Do you have examples of how districts have gotten some of that money?
Yeah, multiple districts have passed a referenda to get this done. Hamilton Southeastern Schools passed a $17 million referenda in 2016. There's also state grant funding for this kind of work. So up until this point, it's been a lot of kind of piecing it together.
There's been a lot of discussion on this topic, and most of it's centered around how to implement and improve mental health services in schools. But there's also the question of whether or not it's the school's responsibility, right, to provide mental health services at all. And what have you heard about that debate? Is it the school's responsibility? What are people saying?
Right. So the idea that this falls on the schools is a relatively new one. But, you know, if you think about, you wouldn't go to a school nurse if you broke your leg. You probably wouldn't go to a police officer based in a school if a crime happened to you. But it's become a school's responsibility to provide mental health for their students. And some people say it's not. That's not a school's job. You know, that's the parent's job. But other people might say that, you know, kids spend probably more time at school than just about anywhere else. And so the reality of it is this has fallen to the schools.
It's unfortunate that we even have to bring it up, but school shootings shine perhaps the biggest spotlight on issues like mental health. But mental health in schools has been top of mind for education officials for some time now, and I understand that that's because of suicide and suicidal ideation. How big a problem is that in Indiana?
There's data that kids in Indiana have suicidal ideation at higher rates than the national average.
Really?
Die by suicide at rates higher than the national average as well.
Well, in the 2017 Kids Count in Indiana data book from the Indiana Youth Institute tells us that almost 20% of high school students have seriously considered suicide. That's a huge number. Almost 10% reported an attempt, according to the Indiana State Department of Health.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. And if you look at certain subgroups, those numbers are even higher, especially in LGBTQ youth. Those numbers will be higher. But there is some concern that the data is not necessarily the full picture, because in Indiana, CDC Youth Risk Behavior Survey, where some of these numbers are gathered, is not mandated. And so not every school gives the survey. So there are some people that are concerned that that may not be an entirely accurate picture. But people have also told me it's more likely to be underreported than overreported.
Incomplete data keeps us from being able to adequately assess the situation, right? What are some of the consequences of not having that reliable data?
Yeah, some lawmakers say, you know, without this reliable data, are we just throwing money at problems that we don't understand? And so I think that is the concern, that if we could better identify, and this isn't a survey that's not just suicide, but also substance abuse and other risk behaviors of kids. So the concern is, are we throwing money at issues that we don't entirely understand?
Efforts to address these statistics have been in motion in some communities for years now. Back in 2015, Mayor Scott Fadness of Fishers wanted to get ahead of this and launched a community conversation around mental health, which included the police force, fire department, healthcare providers, and the schools. Why did the mayor think that it was so important to include everyone?
I mean, I think he'd say it's a complicated issue, you know, and it presents, mental health presents in different ways. And so if you can get everybody to the table having a level of cross communication, you know, people can work together. If the police came across an individual who's maybe in crisis, they can have a conversation with the hospital or the fire department and, you know, maybe implementing red flag laws or that sort of thing. I think his argument is that getting people to the table is the first step.
Well, in the Fisher School District, Hamilton Southeastern has been held up as an example of positive, active change concerning mental health in schools. And in 2016, Fishers, and back to the referendum, this was a $17 million referendum to support a partnership with a mental health provider, Community Health Network. This is an outside third party. What does this partnership look like?
It looks like, I think, every Hamilton Southeastern school now has somebody embedded in the school who is an employee of Community Health Network to provide mental health services. And so if I was a student, perhaps, instead of leaving the school for, you know, driving 20 minutes away, 15 minutes away to a provider and receiving an hour of counseling and then coming back to school, I would just do that in school. And it would be billed to my insurance.
Less time away from class.
I think that's the idea. And then also the idea that if I was that counselor, I could have a conversation with that student's teacher or principal about, hey, these are some of the behaviors I'm noticing. And maybe in your classroom, you could, you know, reinforce some of the things I've told the student to work on. And so having continuing to open the line of communication to provide more wraparound services.
Okay, so what role does parental consent play where this is concerned? I mean, this isn't something where the student, I think, would even have the insight to know that they're having issues and go and seek this counseling sort of on their own. The parents have to be involved, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Nothing happens. No treatment would ever be provided without a parental consent, without an explicit opt-in for their students, which can sometimes create problems if students or the people around those students really feel like they need treatment and it's not being signed off on.
How is this paid for? Is the student's insurance then billed for these services?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's typically how it works.
Well, so then where does the referendum money come? Where does it go?
Mm. Yeah, and I mean, I think in HSC's case, they have several personnel that they hired to help implement and monitor this like the relationship with the Community Health Network. But some of the money is, I mean, like we just talked about, if I was a counselor having that conversation with a principal, that's not free. That time is not free. And private health insurance typically does not pay for that interaction. And so some of these referenda funds would support stuff like that.
There seem to be two schools of thought when it comes to mental health programs in schools. There's traditional in-school resources, therapists and counselors being one. And then there's what Hamilton Southeastern and a lot of other school districts are doing, and that's partnering with these third-party providers. What are the arguments for these different strategies?
So on one side of the spectrum is hiring counselors, special education teachers, social workers, and those would be school employees. The argument for them is, you know, that tends to be more sustainable. You know, they're employees of the school. Aren't going anywhere. But I guess the argument for bringing in a nonprofit is, you know, that could be more specialized treatment, you know, more one-on-one care. And then also, you know, it's much lower cost to the school in the school district. You're not hiring another person. And I've talked to people who say, you know, am I going to hire a counselor or another teacher? That's the choice. And it's a difficult choice to make.
Yeah. What are the needs? And can other communities even do what Fishers has done? I mean, what's Fishers' response to people who say that their success is wonderful, but it's a result of their financial resources, more money in Fishers?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's no denying that there was a $17 million referenda passed to make this work happen. But I think people, Mayor Fadness would certainly say that having a conversation is free. Creating a memorandum of understanding with a provider like Community Health Network is usually very low cost. And to say that it's impossible is not also fair, because Indianapolis Public Schools has done the same system, different needs, but similar bringing in outside providers into their schools.
And they're also integrating social workers as well at IPS.
Yeah.
What role do they play?
And those would be IPS. A social worker would be an IPS employee. And most IPS schools have one, and they tend to be sort of, you know, maybe the middleman between a family and a mental health provider, you know, caring for, helping families work out some more basic needs, you know, housing, food. I talked to some social workers who are very much advocates on their students' behalf. If they see a student that they think needs treatment, then they say they were persistent at going to the families and receiving that parental consent if they really thought it was necessary, especially in communities where maybe there's some more distrust of providers or schools or police.
Well, and you did some reporting from George S. Buck Elementary School on the Far East Side. Mm-hmm. And they're dealing with issues like poverty, drug addiction, gun violence. And so from the outside, it looks really different from like the Fisher School District, Hamilton Southeastern Schools. How does the conversation around mental health shift in an environment with these kinds of challenges?
Yeah. And this school I went to was an elementary school, George S. Buck. And yeah, like you said, these kids are coming to school, maybe sometimes wondering where my next meal will be, or they were kept up at night because of gunshots in their neighborhood. And people I talked to there really described that school as a quote-unquote trauma school, where kids are sort of dealing with that trauma. And at a young age, that can manifest in sort of unexpected ways. And so that is sort of the conversation around mental health is, you know, how are we going to care for some of these kids' basic needs as opposed to maybe, you know, older kids in a more, you know, affluent school district suffering with really high levels of anxiety over, you know, am I going to get into the school I want? And, you know, and these sort of concerns. And that's not to say that that's not a comparison of the different problems, because your problems are your own problems, but and are both completely valid, but it's just different.
We want to thank Side Effects for partnering with us on this episode today. Their team has worked on a series of stories regarding mental health in schools. Carter, where can we find those stories if we want to know more?
Yeah, sure. They're on our website at sideeffectspublicmedia.org. This and other stories are part of a series on mental health in schools, and they're all available on our website.
Carter Barrett, thank you so much for your time today and your reporting.
Thank you.
Up next, we'll hear more about how the Hamilton Southeastern School District coordinates their in-school mental health efforts with the person who's responsible for just that, Brooke Lawson. And we'll hear from Republican Senator Michael Kreider, who has pushed for legislation to connect Indiana students with mental health care services in schools. I'm Matt Pelser. That's next. This is All In. Back in 2 minutes. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking about mental health care in Indiana schools. We talked a lot in the last segment about the approach that Hamilton Southeastern Schools has taken. And joining us is their mental health and school counseling coordinator, Brooke Lawson. Brooke, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
We're also joined by Senator Michael Kreider, who has pushed for legislation to connect Indiana students with mental health treatment. Senator, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you.
And as always, we welcome your questions and comments for our panel regarding mental health services in Indiana schools. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. Until then, lots to talk about. Brooke Lawson, you are the mental health and school counseling coordinator at Hamilton Southeastern Schools. Your district has been pointed to as an example of a successful model for how to address mental health within schools. And interestingly enough, your schools established their mental health initiative within a larger local response to suicide. Can you talk about how the community and Mayor Fadness became invested in this issue?
Sure. So back in 2015, our mayor started looking into what types of mental health supports we were providing to our community members. And as a part of that, he asked the schools to be a part of the task force that took a look at that. And really, the whole first phase was looking at what are the structures and training and supports that we have in place for those in our community that are struggling with mental illness or mental health challenges. And so that's where our referendum, that's part of where our referendum started. So our community came around the need for mental health supports in our schools. And I believe that part of our stigma-free campaign as the city of Fishers played a huge role in that.
And it's my understanding that he brought a lot of people to the table for this. What are the challenges of getting so many community stakeholders to the table on this issue?
I do believe that some community members and community stakeholders have different thoughts about the issue. I think one of the great things about our community and him bringing everyone together is that we're all working together to address this issue. I've talked to colleagues in other school districts where they don't have as great a relationships with their school resource officers or their police officers. And mental health challenges don't just happen at school. They happen at home and in the community. And so I think we're really lucky in the fact that we have a team that's really working together on this issue.
And when it came time to remodel how mental health services functioned in the schools, what changed in the district?
So that was part of the referendum, and the district set aside $400,000.
Of the $17
million. Yes, to address the mental health needs of students in our district. We have wonderful school counselors at all of our schools, but they didn't really have the time to provide ongoing mental health support to students, and it really makes a whole lot of sense to provide that service right there at school. And so we, once the referendum was passed, we set aside that money. We put out a request for proposals looking for a mental health provider to provide those services to school or to students at school.
Your schools have talked about mental health services being more than programs.
Yes.
But rather a shift in the way that you educate mm-hmm. children. Mm-hmm. And what do you mean by that?
So I believe that we have taken a really holistic approach to the putting these supports in place and also addressing the mental health needs of students. So we have therapists in every school. We have our school counselors in every school. But this year, we are looking at teaching social-emotional skills. So I believe social-emotional learning is so much more than just teaching lessons. But we are taking approaches in our district to teaching social-emotional skills. So our students this year in most schools we're piloting this year are receiving weekly skill-building lessons around things like skills for learning, problem-solving, empathy, emotion management, understanding their brain. And we believe that's really important that every kid gets that lesson, because that then gives them those skills that if they do experience a mental health challenge, they're more likely to be able to handle it without it developing into something more serious.
And so I understand this is happening in K through 8, which is a crucial time for this sort of thing.
Yes, yes.
And how important are these proactive programs in creating a culture that understands and accepts mental health?
I think they're very important. I think if we can start looking at these skills are just important as teaching reading and math and writing, that we'll actually get to a point where we're addressing the whole child.
And at the same time, it's not just the students that need this extra attention. I mean, we're talking about supporting and training teachers and parents as well. And that's an important element.
Yes, of course. And we back before I started, actually, the district took some steps to give all of our teachers really important training around the signs and symptoms of a student who might be in crisis and need connection to a higher level of support.
When I was in school, if a student had a mental health problem, they would go to a traditional counselor, if they went to anyone at all. And these are people that have much more on their plate. As the responsibility of mental health services shifts to the third party providers, how are the roles of these traditional counselors shifting?
Are you talking about school counselors?
Yeah, guidance counselors.
So I believe that our school counselors play a huge role. They are really the connector. When our students are dealing with everyday issues that kids deal with and they need an adult to talk to, that's the role of our school counselor. When our students get to the point where the mental health challenge that they're experiencing is impacting their daily functioning, that's when they need a referral to a higher level of support.
And the counselor is sort of trained to see where that line is.
Yes, and they are able to make those referrals. They're also running groups with students. Our school counselors do a great job running groups with our students. They're seeing kids individually. They're helping with our special education work. They're a big leader in the social-emotional learning. They're pulling kids who maybe didn't understand the lesson that was taught that week and need a little bit more extra support.
When we talk about mental health care, the issue of confidence comes in and confidentiality.
Yeah.
But in this case, we're talking about students and a school administration. What do the lines of communication look like between healthcare providers, the student, and teachers or principals?
Mm-hmm. So no student in our districts receives mental health support from our third-party provider without parent consent, and our parents are actively involved in that treatment. You wouldn't be able to treat a child without their parent being involved. It wouldn't be very successful. But the counselors work with administrators and teachers, but they share information on a need to know basis. So our families sign a release of information for the student to participate in services at school, but that mental health therapist is not sharing all the confidential information with people in the school. What they really do is work alongside those people to help them to provide support to the student that's needed to make them successful.
How many of your students are receiving services through this program?
So last school year, we had 853 students that received support. Since we started the contract, over 1,200 students have received support. So that's a lot. That's a lot of students.
Have you seen the results? How are students benefiting?
Yep, we have. We've seen an increase in test scores of the students who received mental health therapy at school. We've seen an increase in their GPA. We've seen an increase in their attendance and a decrease in disciplinary infractions.
When Fisher set out to seriously take a look at mental health, I understand that their plan of action was broken into phases.
Yes.
What phase are we currently in, and what's still left to go?
So we're still in phase two, and it has a couple different arms. We want to finish everything in phase one. So one of the things that was still that we were still working on was our first responders to mental health crisis in our community. So we just in, I think it was January, launched a program where we have firefighters who are trained to respond to mental health crisis. So they actually go on runs with our police officers, and they have additional training, which is really, really beneficial for our community members. Part of phase two, so it is access to services and resources. We still have the community awareness campaign. We have policy work. And then we're still just working as a team to identify what we need to put into place.
Senator Kreider, you've been a proponent for legislation that'll connect more students with mental health care and treatment. Now, how important is it for schools to have support from the state?
Well, there are some school systems that have stepped out in front, like Hamilton Southeastern has done, the Fishers community. But as you look at the state, you realize that there are communities that just don't have the resources and probably will not, with the exception of a grant-type program like I tried to create this last session. A lot of what's been said already, several key words are so important in this discussion. I think I come from a law enforcement background, and so when I was elected to legislature, I was actually working at Hancock Regional Hospital as their director of security and disaster management, and I got to see mental health challenge, really the crisis portion of challenge, playing out in the ER on a daily basis. So mental health and little key bills that I've worked over the last seven sessions, things like telemedicine and trying to increase the number of providers that might be available, step therapy, which deals with prescription drugs and how when folks move around in different plans, they maybe have failed on a lower cost drug two or three times and gotten to a drug that's really working for them. And so bills to try to fix that type of situation. But I think what I realized over the years and the other bill that's really important in this discussion is the CIT bill that I carried in 2015, which really is providing NAMI-based, National Alliance for Mental Illness-based training for, in Hancock County, it's our police, our firefighters, our EMS, and the dispatchers that take the calls from the community. Do they understand what they're dealing with at the time, and do they have the ability to connect that individual to services, as opposed to the more traditional thing has been, the more difficult the person, the more likely they are to end up in incarceration. And so I think we're trying to figure out ways to deflect folks out of the criminal justice system and use things like CIT and use things like problem-solving courts to try to solve some of these issues and really serve that population in a way that they deserve to be served.
We're speaking kind of broadly about mental health issues, but there are certain tipping points, you know, that bring these sort of things into the forefront. What are the areas of concern you're trying to address through this legislation specifically?
Well, so I think this last session I looked really hard. I had two bills in particular that I worked the most on. Senate Bill 325 we got passed, and it's a parental support grant program that allows the Secured Schools Grant to be opened up for the first time and used for schools to apply for a piece of that grant. I'm a member, past member of the law enforcement community, and I think I understand, and most of us do, that until we can address the student who has suicidal thoughts, who's willing to take their own life and potentially take classmates with them, then we're not really going to get ahead of this school safety discussion. And so I was really pleased to get Senate Bill 325 done. And then Senate Bill 359 looks at individualized mental health safety plans. As we discussed a little bit earlier, the schools need some mechanism to share information between the different levels of this discussion. And Senate Bill 359 really starts to help the folks that engage in community-based paramedicine, the EMS providers that are going out and interacting directly with that individual. Do they know from his therapist what his safety plan looks like, the things that will de-escalate him? Does he have a service animal? Does he have a most trusted individual that they could call to the scene and help calm that situation down? Senate Bill 359 will be another tool that communities like Fishers can use to help facilitate communication, because communication is so key in these situations.
You've spoken about how oftentimes, unless the issue of mental health touches your life in some way, it's hard to grapple with or understand the importance of it. How did this become a meaningful issue for you?
I think it really – I saw the faces of it over 6 years working at the hospital. We had in my family, we had some mental illness, and I had a cousin who struggled with addiction for years until he finally hung himself. Mm. And I think if your family has no individual with some form of chronic depression or some level of mental illness in it, you're extremely fortunate. I think the idea that there's a stigma attached to mental illness just completely needs to go away. It's one of those situations that most individuals, if they're assessed properly and given the proper medication, they can function really very well. It's the challenge being what I would see happen in emergency situation and crisis is individuals that are on medication take it until they start feeling really good, and then they think, I don't need this anymore, and they quit taking it. And it's kind of a gradual slide down to a crisis point again, but they eventually hit bottom, and they end up in the ER. And, I was always so kind of frustrated because we could fix their heart attack or we could fix their broken arm, but we really couldn't fix their mental health challenge. The thing that it exposed me to, though, is I got to hear individual stories, and I got to know little things about how bipolar disorder combined with explosive personality disorder creates this really volatile situation and why folks would end up in the ER. And so I think I decided, so long as I have the opportunity to serve in the General Assembly, that mental illness will be a focus for me. And, as a policymaker, I perhaps can change some laws that facilitate better conditions for the people that are doing the direct provision of care. And to me, that's really a satisfying thing to be a part of.
Brooke Lawson, we heard from Brad on Twitter who says, Hamilton Southeastern's program saved my son's life. I mean, how does that make you feel when you hear something like that?
Well, I think that we have a great team of people in our schools. It makes me so proud of all of them and proud of our district for making this a priority.
Do you think that conversations like this and some of the work you're doing, Senator Kreider, help to sort of chip away at the stigma? And what are some other ways we can do that?
Right. I think so. I had a really difficult path with my legislation this last session. A lot of kind of outside forces pushing and pulling on it. But I think the more often you have those conversations and people realize, unfortunately, I took a lot of young people to the morgue at the hospital who somebody didn't intercede at the proper time or something went wrong. And so, I think I saw the face of what happens if you don't have programming in place. And, every time I get an opportunity to go on a radio program like this or talk to a group, I'm going to be a part of that conversation. I was the keynote speaker at our Republican dinner a year or so ago, and that was what I talked about, how we all are in this together.
More about the issue of mental health care in Indiana schools when we come back with Hamilton Southeastern School's mental health and school counseling coordinator Brooke Lawson and Senator Michael Kreider. And up next, we'll also hear about how one rural Indiana school district is addressing the mental health of its students. We're back in 2 minutes. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Before we get back to our guests, I want to encourage you to sign up for our topic alerts. If you find yourself near the radio at this time of day and you want to know what we're talking about, we send a small, and I mean very small, email every day. We have a show because email fatigue is a very real thing. You can sign up for that at WFYI.org/all in, and that's also where you can catch up on past shows. Again, WFYI.org/all in. Today on the show, we've been talking about mental health services in Indiana schools, and we've heard a lot about the problems urban and suburban districts face and how they're treating them, but most of Indiana is rural. So we decided to bring in someone who is involved in a program that's helping out a rural southern Indiana school district. We're joined in studio by CareSource Indiana Market President Steve Smitherman. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Your company is an example of a third party that has been behind some of the new strategies to connect students with mental health services. Your organization has just implemented a new digital program at Orleans Junior and Senior High School in Orange County, Indiana, to offer students access to therapists without having to leave school.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. So CareSource is a nonprofit managed care entity here in the state of Indiana that serves individuals on the marketplace and Hoosier HealthWise and Healthy Indiana Medicaid plans. And we're really an organization that looks to ensure that all our members have access to the most quality care that they can. And as was discussed earlier, I mean, these kids are spending most of their lives in school. And we kind of looked across the state, and as we all know, there's a significant shortage of behavioral health and mental health providers, especially in the rural areas of the state. So we looked where we could go where there was a significant shortage. And in this particular community, they do not have any behavioral health providers. So we work closely with the school district to determine what services we could bring to them that would best suit their students. And that work included interviewing janitors, school bus drivers, teachers, the principals, everybody on what was the best solution. And ultimately what was determined was a telehealth solution. So we partner with IU Health, and we've provided the equipment and everything that the school needs for these kids to go during the school day into a private room. To have a one-on-one visit with a provider. Now, that provider will be dependent on their needs, whether that be a psychologist, a psychiatrist, a social worker, whatever that child is needing. And then working, as Brooke said earlier, directly with those families and ensuring that there's a plan put in place for those individuals. My team spent every day down at that school during back-to-school nights, and what we found was the families were overly receptive to this process. So received, a number of families that signed up immediately for their child to receive this service. And we'll continue to monitor it. A lot of our success factors are what Brooke talked about earlier. We're looking at school attendance, standardized test grades, ER visits, inpatient behavioral health stays, all those types of things. And see how it works over the course of the year. And then we're also in talks with another school up in northwest Indiana in a rural setting that we hope to employ this same technology to, if not in the second semester of this year, then the beginning of next school year.
So how many students have we treated with this? How many students are we helping?
Well, it just started this school year, so they're just back to school. There's about 600 kids in junior, senior high school there. So those are the individuals that we're targeting right now and are anxious to get them up to speed and started on this process.
I hear that, and I hear, you know, the size of my graduating class. I mean, this is rural Indiana. It's just I think it's great that there's a program like this in rural Indiana.
Sure, and I think also just for, you know, I think the face of Medicaid has changed so much over the last 10 years, where what you have in that population these days are families that have two jobs, three jobs, trying to support the household. So those parents can't take off and go get their kid out of school and take them to a visit, even if that access existed. So this is just another option for the families. And this is not limited to just our members. It's open to the entire community. So we hope it's something that's really going to help. As you've talked here today, a lot of the staggering statistics that Indiana ranks very low on in regards to school, high school children in particular, suicide thoughts, those types of things. You know, if we can help one student, then, you know, that's we'll be satisfied.
As you said, we're really early in on this program, just started this school year. What are the goals of this program?
Well, I think a little bit what we talked about earlier. One, obviously giving them access to services. Two, you know, helping them over, you know, what we tried to look at when we did the survey is what are the most common things that we see here. Obviously, social media has its good and bad, right? And one of the prevalent things we heard in our survey is social media stress, is how they referred it in the school system, that they have a number of kids that have come to teachers or guidance counselors or so on and so forth that just didn't know how to deal with what was going on social media, either being attacked or their friends being attacked or those types of things. And you know, a lot of the things that we've seen recently in the news where social media posts have been able to help the FBI, you know, stop some potential mass shootings and those types of things where kids are going to the teachers and saying, hey, I think I have a friend that may be thinking about doing this and I don't know what to do. So this will give that child the avenue to be able to express that concern with a professional and then hopefully, you know, through the work of the school and others, get those individuals that need help the help they need.
Are there models of similar programs that have existed like this before? Are you modeling yours?
Well, there's telehealth services that exist a lot of places, but
sure.
Generally that's for physical health. There's not a lot of behavioral health telehealth services out there. So we haven't found a lot to date that exist. So we're excited to launch this pilot to see how it works. And our goal, hopefully, is to get this in every single rural school across the state of Indiana over time if it's successful.
That was going to be my next question. Are you looking to expand these services?
Absolutely. Yeah. We're in the process now of setting up a website for schools to go to notify us not only of behavioral health services but other services that children may need. And then working, we have a team of school-based staff that go out and work with the schools on how we can best serve their students.
Speaking of digital solutions like telehealth, several school districts have implemented anonymous tip lines to report bullying, suspicious activity as well, and concerns about a student. Other schools have developed digital platforms that allow students to communicate anonymously with teachers simply to ask questions that they may have about life, which they would then feel otherwise uncomfortable asking in person. How important is it to be building these lines of communication with students, Brooke Lawson?
I believe that that's a really important step that school districts need to take. I think as we were talking a little bit about, you know, students in crisis or somebody being concerned about a friend, over the last couple of years in our school district, we have implemented specific procedures that the adults take when a student is worried about another student or a student themselves discloses that they're thinking about harming themselves. And we have seen an increase. We've also been very clear with our students. If you're struggling, get help. We have supports here in place for you. And we've seen the trend of the number of students coming forward go up. Each semester, we've seen more and more kids coming forward. But we actually think that's a good thing because we think that we've gotten the word out that we have support. You don't have to struggle with whatever it is that you're dealing with by yourself. We have support in place for you. And so we actually saw a slight decrease in the spring semester of the number of students coming forward. So we're really proud of that. And we're hoping that as we continue to put the supports in place and make sure that our students know that there is no harm in telling somebody that you're struggling, we'll get you the support that you need. And mental illness is treatable. So if you get the right supports in place, you're likely to be in recovery.
We're talking more here, obviously, about breaking away from that stigma. Mm-hmm. And it's easy to say, look, you can come and talk to me. It's mm-hmm. and you know, please feel free to do so. But it's another thing to convince them that what you're saying is true and that mm-hmm. And that you really mean it. What are other ways you have of sort of breaking down that barrier of stigma?
So in our high schools, we actually have stigma-free clubs that were actually started by some students. So the first year that I started in Hamilton Southeastern Schools, a student approached me and said, I'd really like to start a mental health club in my high school, and I need a sponsor. And my principal said that you might help me. And so I said, I would love to help you. I don't really know what that would look like, but let's talk about this. And we're very clear on the role of the club. The role was to educate peers and community about mental health and mental illness, because they're two different things, to be a voice for people who struggle, and just to be a resource. And that club has been wildly successful in both our high schools, so much so that the Indiana School Mental Health Initiative has come alongside us. We're now connected to a national club called Bring Change to Mind, which is more of the clubs have been on the West Coast. But actually this year, the Indiana Department of Education has agreed to allow any high school in the state to have a club like this. And so we feel like that is helping, because now our students are going to their peers, because that's who kids talk to when they're struggling. They tell each other. And so our kids know, I should never keep this a secret. I have to tell an adult.
Steve Smitherman, is this issue of the school sort of getting involved to let them know that you indeed have a program available to sort of break down the stigma? Are they getting involved in that way as well?
They are, I think so. Yeah, and again, you know, unfortunately, a lot of the schools don't have the resources that Birth School has, so we need to try to be creative in getting them the resources that they need. But they're all on board and very excited about it. A lot of them are very financially strapped, so it's not like they can add personnel or add additional dollars, to the school budget. So we're there for, to find those resources for them. And it may not care from come CareSource. We have a number of community partners we're working with that are assisting along the way. And those exist in every community. It's just knowing who to go to get that help. And I think that's one of the things one of the biggest assets we bring to the school is we know where to go for what they need. And, as long as they're engaged in working with us, we think it can be a successful partnership, and we're excited about it and look forward to seeing the outcomes of this.
As we discussed earlier, the data around youth and mental health in Indiana schools is not necessarily complete. What do we have that can provide limited insight? There's more findings from the 2017 Kids Count in Indiana data book that suggests that youth in Indiana experience feelings of hopelessness, sadness, as well as periods of depression at higher rates than the national average. Are there underlying concerns that we're missing here? Brooke, are there factors unique to students today that contribute to increased rates of these feelings?
You know, I'm sure that there probably are. I do think that social media could potentially play a huge role. I think just the fact that our kids are always connected. When I was in school, I got to go to school and come home and disconnect from that. But our kids don't get to do that these days. And so I think that that does play a role. But I also think that we, in our school district, we just want to be really clear that if you're struggling with something, talk to an adult, because that's what we're here for.
If a parent or a student or a community member is concerned about a student's mental health, what are the right steps to take then?
So, it all depends on that person's comfort level. They can contact the school and we'll take it from there. If they're not comfortable doing that, they can use one of our anonymous tip lines. We're actually launching a new one in a couple of weeks. And so they can use that to communicate those concerns. They can contact me at our central office. They can call 911. So they have a couple of options.
Speaking to a peer or student about their mental health can be uncomfortable mm-hmm. and unfamiliar. We talked about the stigma. Do you have any suggestions about how to best approach a student who you think might be having problems? Have you had to deal with that yourself? How do you open those doors?
Yeah, so I think that that can be an uncomfortable topic for some people. I think there's tons of resources and tools out there and training, like mental health first aid. And we're trying to work with our teachers to just come alongside a student and say, if you're noticing a change in a child's behavior, either talk to the school counselor and have them speak with that student, or just say, like, I really care a lot about you, and I've noticed that you're acting different. Is something going on?
Senator Kreider, we so often these things get sparked by some tragic event.
Sure.
And then people – there's a call to action. There's a call for mental health, and some people call for gun reform. And then it subsides. Do you think that there's still enough momentum now to keep this going? I mean, the two school shootings were in 2018. It's 2019. We're more than halfway through the year.
Yeah.
What about the momentum?
I think that one of the things I'm finding the most encouraging is that it seems like across the spectrum of our neighborhoods, people are recognizing this problem. In Hancock County, our hospital community, our hospital foundation is doing a fundraising campaign to create an endowment so that they can fund more mental health providers within our community. And it'll be kind of a perpetual fund that they can tap into. Our faith-based community, like Brandywine Church, is starting a Wellspring Center as kind of a triage point. They do some services there, but certainly they have the ability to connect folks to professionals, more highly trained individuals for those folks where it's appropriate. I think, you know, the shootings and things like that have driven some of this discussion, but if you're involved with the law enforcement community, you realize that there are a number of folks who are just kind of constantly dialing 911. They need somebody to talk to. They need something in their lives because they have nobody else to connect with, really. And you're starting to see discussion around community-based paramedicine programs where the paramedics, when they aren't on a run, they have individuals in the community they go by and check on. Even some hospitals have figured out that to keep their readmissions down, they can contract with some of these fire departments to have that service for somebody who was recently discharged. There are a number of things that we can build upon that have already kind of organically started, and I think I find that really encouraging. As a policymaker and as somebody that sits as a member of the budget-making committee in the Senate, I realize everything is about money. And so as Brooke and these other programs start to develop these successes that we can measure, I'm perfectly comfortable with going back and asking for more money in that secured schools grant pool so that more schools have that opportunity across the state. I think, you know, unfortunately, we will continue to see tragic events. And in spite of everybody's best effort, we will have those occur. But together, we can really make a big difference in this discussion.
You talked about people needing people to talk to. The number to call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 800-273-8255. That's 800-273-TALK, 273-TALK. I want to thank you all for your perspectives. Hamilton Southeastern School's Mental Health and School Counseling Coordinator Brooke Lawson, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Senator Michael Kreider.
Pleasure to be with you.
CareSource Indiana Market President Steve Smitherman, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And we want to welcome producer Drew Dodlin to the team. Yesterday was his first day on the job. We thank him for all the hard work. You might recognize his name as our former city reporter. We loved him so much in that role. We're so glad he's joining us on All In. Of course, a big thanks to Jill Sheridan for filling in while I was on paternity leave. I am sleepy, but I'm glad to be back to work. And mom and baby, are doing just fine. Next time on All In, we'll talk about evictions. Indiana is just one of many states where tenants can be evicted without much notice or cause. This has cast some of our most vulnerable residents out onto the streets. We want to hear from you on this issue. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.